Good evening. A black man dies under the knee of a cop in Minneapolis as he cries, "I can't breathe." Cameras are rolling. And is FEMA stealing PPE due to frontline medical workers? With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the news for Tuesday, May 26, 2020. A black man died after his neck was crushed under the knee of a Minneapolis police officer, as depicted in a cell phone video that became public on Monday. In an incident that evoked the choking death of Eric Garner in 2014, the man begged the white officer, saying, "I can't breathe.
I can breathe. Please, the knee of my neck. I can't breathe shit."
You gonna let him kill that man in front of you, bro? Huh?
Like, what?
Bro, he's not even f***ing moving right now, bro.
I can't breathe. Oh, my God. It will kill me, man.
A crowd of bystanders begged the cop to remove his knee as other officers kept people away.
The victim was George Floyd. Officials have not publicly named the officer who did the choking, but Minneapolis Star Tribune newspaper identified him as Derek Chauvin. Chauvin and three other officers involved have reportedly been fired from the Minneapolis police force, and federal authorities are investigating. In an early morning news conference at City Hall, Mayor Jacob Frey said it was clear from the video that race played a part in the encounter.
"For 5 minutes, we watched as a white officer pressed his knee into the neck of a black man. For 5 minutes. When you hear someone calling for help, you are supposed to help. This officer failed in the most basic human sense. What happened on Chicago and 38th, this last night, is simply awful. It was traumatic, and it serves as a clear reminder of just how far we have to go. To the black community, to the family, I'm so sorry."
Mayor Jacob Frey of Minneapolis. The chain of events that led to the man's death started about 8 p.m. Monday when police were called to investigate a report of someone trying to pay with a counterfeit bill at a local store. According to police and scanner audio posted online, they found the man matching the suspect's description sitting on the hood of his car. Officers ordered him out of the car and took him into custody. Reportedly, their body cameras were turned on. The incident was streamed by a bystander on Facebook Live, where the archive footage has been watched nearly 80,000 times as of Tuesday morning. The video captures a scene from behind a police SUV, showing the man lying face down on the ground next to the rear passenger wheel, writhing in pain while repeatedly telling police he couldn't breathe as they held him down under their knee, one officer's knee. A police news release said a man struggling with police suffered a medical episode and died at the hospital a short time later. A protest is planned at the intersection at this hour. And in New York City, the Center for Constitutional Rights filed a motion today against the city of New York. The motion asked the court to direct Peter Zimroth, the court-appointed monitor in the Stop and Frisk case, to conduct an investigation into the NYPD's social distancing enforcement practices and report his findings to the parties, the court, and the public. Since March 20th, 81% of NYPD summonses for social distancing violations were issued to Black and Latinx persons. The CCR motion says, in white neighborhoods, irrespective of affluence, the NYPD has not enforced social distancing to the same extent, despite large gatherings and persistently crowded parks, bars, and religious schools or ceremonies. Mayor Bill de Blasio addressed the motion today at his daily briefing.
"We've been working very closely with the monitor throughout. This is the administration that settled the stop and frisk case. We've done very productive work with the monitor. If the monitor has concerns, we're always going to work cooperatively. If there's a legal action being taken by an outside group, I want to just be mindful that I'll keep my comments brief. But look, we do believe in transparency. Wherever we can get clear information, it's always important to make sure the information is clear and consistent. I want to see it published regularly. But again, any looking at what happened with the very few instances where there was enforcement on social distancing, and I keep coming back to this, I don't blame anyone for the concern about things that went wrong or disparities. Both of those are unacceptable. Any incident where the dynamics between police and community weren't what we wanted to be, where our police officers didn't handle things right, we care about. Any time where there's disparity, I care about that, the department cares about it, we have to fix it. But I also want to keep coming back to, if thank God we're talking about very few instances where there even was any enforcement, and now that has ended. But we're always ready to take a look back if it helps us do our job better going forward. We're just not going to tolerate disparities in this city. That's the bottom line.
Says it's racism pure and simple. A viral video caught a woman in Central Park calling the cops on a black man for complaining about her unleashed dog. In the video of the Monday encounter, the woman, real name Amy Cooper, but widely dubbed Central Park Karen, loses it and threatens to call the police when bird watcher Christian Cooper, no relation, asks her to abide by park rules and put her dog on a leash. The dog walker said in the video, "I'm going to tell them there's an African-American man threatening my life." She called the police because he was a black man, de Blasio tweeted, even though she was the one breaking the rules. She decided he was the criminal, and we know why. This kind of hatred has no place in our city. The NYPD has said it isn't pursuing any charges against Cooper. A Karen is a misogynist slang for a middle-aged woman who calls authorities for no reason. And as the coronavirus continues to hobble New York and the world, the New York Stock Exchange opened for the first time in months. The governor rang the opening bell. Linda Perry has the report.
Governor Andrew Cuomo opened up this week at the New York Stock Exchange with new COVID cases at its lowest number and deaths, while still tragic, also at their lowest number. The governor turned to plans for reopening across the state, except for New York City, where zip codes with the highest infection rates will be a focus in an effort to slow the spread. He emphasized a safe reopening plan with a Fiorello LaGuardia-style get-back-to-work rebuilding program. It invigorates renewables and moves forward on fixing and improving infrastructure, like a fast train to LaGuardia Airport, Hudson River tunnels, and completing the 2nd Avenue subway expansion from 96th Street to 125th Street in Manhattan. Here's Governor Andrew Cuomo at his Monday, May 26th COVID briefing.
Let's start with the facts. Facts first. That's what the American people need. Number of hospitalizations down. Great news. Rolling average down. Number of intubations down. Number of new COVID cases down to the lowest level since this ever started, just about 200. Amen. Number of lives lost, 73. That's the lowest level that we have seen since. So again, in this absurd new reality, that is good news. Any other time and place when we lose 73 New Yorkers, it's tragic. It's tragic now, but relative to where we've been, we're on the other side of the curve, and that is the lowest number that we've had. So we thank all the healthcare staff once again, doctors, nurses who have been doing a fantastic job. And you see, we went up the mountain very quickly. That spike took us up very quickly. And it took a long time to come down, but we're still coming down. While we're reopening, supercharge the reopening, right? Stock market open today. We want that economy to come roaring back. We want it to come roaring back. And that's not going to happen just by wishing it to be so. We have to take an affirmative action. We have to be part of that. And today is page one of that chapter. You need to restart the economy. You need to create jobs. And you need to renew and repair this country's economy and its infrastructure. Now is the time to do it. It's especially the time to do it when some of the volume is lower, right? The time to fix the hole in the roof, we would say in Queens, is when the sun is shining. That's when you, well, you don't think that's a Queen's expression? That was a Queen's expression as far as I'm concerned. That's when you fix the hole in the roof, when the sun is shining. The time to do this work is now, when you need the jobs and the volume is low, and New York will lead the way. We are going to accelerate our big infrastructure programs. We have the Empire Station project, which is building a new Penn Station, which is long overdue. That Penn Station has been torturing people for too long. Let's now accelerate the Empire Penn project while the ridership is low and when we need the jobs. Accelerating LaGuardia Airport, which is going to be the first new airport in this nation in 25 years. Traffic is low. Passenger volume is lower. Let's accelerate that construction now. And let's do things that we've been talking about for a long time, but we've never actually pulled the trigger on. We know that we need renewable power. We know we can generate renewable power in upstate. We know we need it downstate. Let's build the cross-state transmission lines to develop that renewable market upstate and satisfy the need downstate. We know they have low-cost hydropower in Canada. Let's run the cable, the transmission lines from Canada to New York City to get that power down here, and let's stop talking and let's start doing. Let's invigorate this whole renewable market. And there are other big infrastructure projects that we've been talking about, which we have to do, where we need federal help and federal approval. Let's put those on the table. The AirTrain to LaGuardia. New York City is one of the only major cities that has no train from the airport into the central city. We've been talking about the cross-Hudson tunnels, where the Amtrak trains come through, that are old and that are crumbling, and that if they become a problem, you literally stop Amtrak travel to the entire Northeast. Let's stop the politics on it, and let's get it done, and let's build those new tunnels. The 2nd Avenue subway, the next extension for the 2nd Avenue subway goes from 96th Street to 125th Street. Would open up that whole 125th Street area. It would bring a whole new chapter of revitalization to New York City. Let's do that in partnership with the federal government. I'm going to go to Washington tomorrow, scheduled to meet with the president to talk about a number of things, but this is one of the things I want to talk to the president about. You want to restart the economy, you want to reopen the economy. Let's do something creative. Let's do it fast. Let's put Americans back to work, and let's make America better. It is common sense. It is common sense. So many of the things that we need to do, you don't need to be a government expert or an engineer to figure out. It's common sense. You have an infrastructure that's crumbling. You need to jumpstart the economy. You need to create jobs. Do it now. Do it now. And that's what I'm. One of the things I'm going to talk to the president about tomorrow.
Thanks, Linda. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul D'Arienzo. For the first time, the city of New York is facilitating delivery of methadone to patients who would otherwise be required to go pick up their medication at a clinic. A move designed to slow the spread of COVID-19 among high-risk populations. Around 28,500 people are enrolled in methadone clinics or opioid treatment programs. Under normal circumstances, most of them must report to their OTP, that's the site of their reception, the methadone clinic, as we've often called them, each morning and take that day's dose under supervision. As of May 19th, the city has made 40 deliveries to isolation hotels and 16 to participants' homes. Each delivery also comes with a kit containing naloxone, the medication used to rapidly reverse opioid overdose. The methadone delivery program will remain in place for the foreseeable future. Activists and patients have long advocated for methadone regulation and reform of methadone regulation and hope it will continue after the COVID-19 threat has dissipated. And the group National Nurses United has been conducting a nationwide survey of registered nurses for the past month. More than 23,000 nurses filled out the survey about their experiences working during the COVID-19 pandemic, and the group says the responses are loud and clear. While it's been months since COVID-19 struck the United States, they say our employers and the government are still not protecting us nurses and our patients. Deborah Berger is president of the National Nurses United. She says frontline medical workers are sometimes forced to use bandanas because of a shortage of PPE. She also says FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, has seized PPE meant for nurses.
The problem continues to be lack of adequate personal protective equipment, despite being in this epidemic for 3 or more months. We still don't have the equipment we need to safely provide care for our patients and to protect us, our families, and our community. So it's still an ongoing fight that seems to have no resolution in sight, despite all of the assurances that they're working on getting us what we need.
If somebody's on the job and they don't have that equipment, who do they complain to, and then who do they pass the complaint to, and where does the buck stop?
That's a bit complicated because our system is not an integrated healthcare system, as you know. We have all of these hospital chains that are for-profit entities, despite the fact that they say that they're not for profit. They still make billions of dollars. And so anytime they can shave off a dollar or two here or deny care, they make money, billions of dollars, in fact. And they've gotten millions of dollars from the federal government to supply the nurses with the equipment they need, and they failed to do so. So nurses on the front lines, we've given them the tools they need to document complaints. They fill out what's called an assignment despite objection form that documents that they weren't given the equipment they need. We go to the state and federal governments and the local public health departments. They record our complaints and say that they're working on it, but we haven't seen the results of anybody's efforts to get us the equipment we need.
Is part of the problem that we just don't have the equipment?
Part of it is that we don't have the equipment, but that's a failure of the federal government. And the only person that can mandate that an industry start ramping up production of masks is President Trump. He's the only one that can use the National Defense Production Act to mandate that a manufacturer start mass producing the masks that we need. So he's yet to use that authority in that manner. So that only lets nurses know that he isn't taking this crisis seriously. And then on the state level, everybody is fending for themselves, and the federal government is seizing many of the shipments of masks that have been procured by the individual states. And then there was an organization that National Nurses United was working with to arrange for masks called the Be a Hero Foundation and Masks for America. And the federal government seized some of those masks. So
where do they go? When the government seizes them, where do they go?
It's crazy.
Where do they go? Where do they put them?
The FEMA. FEMA, under the authority of the federal government, seized the masks. And so,
who wears them then? Who's going to go wear them if the nurses and the frontline people are?
Well, that's what we want to know. Where did the masks go? Did the federal government do what they said that they were going to do, which is to give them to distributors in the United States to resell and make more money? So It's extremely frustrating, especially given that the N95 mask respirator is the fallback equipment for if you don't have the capper or papper system, the pure filtered purified air respirator, right? That's the one with the hood and a little battery pack that powers filtered air through, so it's less onerous to wear. So we don't even have enough of those. And so the N95 mask is the fallback. But because of the federal government, the CDC has weakened its guidelines to say, okay, you can use the N95 mask. If you don't have that, you can use a surgical mask. If you don't have that, you can just use a regular mask. And if you don't even have that, you can use a bandana or a scarf. And so that is not protecting healthcare workers. It's extremely frustrating that in this day and age, with the pandemic as large as it is, that we don't have anyone in charge that really cares about the safety of the workers in any industry. The meatpacking industry, the nursing home industry, the healthcare industry, they're all about making money as opposed to protecting lives.
Where do we go from here? What do we do about this?
We do have a petition online. If you go to protectnurses.org, there are several petitions that you can sign that will demand that President Trump use his National Defense Production Act authority to produce masks, that there be included in the next relief package mandates to provide the equipment that we need, and to make sure that nurses that get COVID-19 or healthcare workers that get COVID-19 will qualify for workers' compensation, which is not the case right now. Nurses and healthcare workers have to prove that they got it on the job.
All right, great. Anything you'd like to add?
We appreciate the support that the public is doing for us, but hand clapping and cheering and all of that won't get us the equipment we need. We need people to step up and put pressure on their hospitals to make sure that nurses get the personal protective equipment they need to safely protect our patients.
How about the rest of us wearing masks?
That would be a start. That would be helpful, because we don't want more patients. We don't want more business. So keep yourself safe out there by wearing a mask.
In an email response to WBAI, spokesperson Lauren Lefebvre says FEMA is not seizing or taking personal protective equipment, PPE, from state or local governments, hospitals, or anyone lawfully engaged in acquiring or distributing PPE. But she also added, 50% of the supplies on each international cargo flight are directed by the distributors to customers in areas with the most critical needs for those supplies. And as a second wave of COVID-19 infections is expected, whether due to early reopening of case states and localities hit hard by the virus or a mix of flu cases this fall, Dr. Mike Ryan of the World Health Organization says the first wave is far from over.
We're not in a second wave. We're right in the middle of the first wave globally. And if we look at the data from Central, from South America, as was spoken about, for Africa, for South Asia, and for many other countries, we're still very much in a phase where the disease is actually on the way up. We cannot make assumptions that just because the disease is on the way down now, it's going to keep going down, and then we're going to get a number of months to get ready for a second wave. We may get a second peak in this wave. This happens during pandemics in the past. It certainly happened in the pandemic 1919 and the Spanish flu. We got a second peak, not necessarily a second wave. Right now, countries in Europe, countries in North America, many other countries around the world in Southeast Asia have to continue to put in place the public health and social measures, the surveillance measures, the public health measures, the testing measures, and a comprehensive strategy to ensure that we continue on a downward trajectory and that we don't have an immediate second peak. We will then have to look later in the year whether or not there's a possibility of a second wave of infections coming. And that's particularly of concern when we look at the possibility of having a second wave of infections that may be also associated with influenza season, which will greatly complicate things for disease control.
So if I may add, yes, I mean, let us be perfectly clear. All countries need to remain on high alert here. All countries need to be ready to rapidly detect cases. Even countries that have had success in suppression, as Mike has said, even countries that have seen a decline in cases must remain ready. A large proportion of the population remains susceptible. That means that this virus, if it finds an opportunity, will start an outbreak. And we need to be very clear on that and need to remain strong, remain vigilant, have our systems in place to readily detect those cases, to care for those cases, to find and trace and quarantine contacts. A hallmark of coronaviruses is its ability to amplify in certain settings, its ability to cause transmission or super spreading events. And we are seeing in a number of situations in these closed settings, when the virus has an opportunity, it can transmit readily. We're seeing it in long-term care facilities. We've seen it in some hospitals. That means that the virus will take that opportunity to amplify if it can. But the good news is that we have the steps, the tools in our toolbox to be able to suppress transmission. And these are the fundamentals of public health. It's about having that public health workforce in place, having the ability to test for cases, to care for those cases, depending on the severity of their symptoms, to find those contacts, to quarantine those contacts, to keep our people, to keep all people fully empowered, engaged, and informed about what the situation is in their setting. And these are the tools that we can use to suppress transmission.
And that's Dr. Maria Van Kerkhove, before her, Dr. Mike Ryan, both of the World Health Organization.